I focus on Croatia because I'm in Croatia and I'm formerly advisor of our prime minister for COVID. So Croatia had the least stringent measures in Europe.
Welcome to the Fat Emperor podcast. I'm your host, Ivor Cummins. We're going to have a fascinating discussion today because I'm delighted to welcome back Professor Gordon Lautz from Croatia, but also he's a professor in the UK. And we had a discussion last year where we made certain predictions and expectations around this viral epidemic and where it would go. And now we're going to circle back and see how accurate they were. So great to see you again, Gordon. Fantastic to have you here.
Thank you for the invitation. It's a pleasure to chat with you. And actually, I just watched what we discussed last September, yesterday, and I think we were quite right then. So, but I'll go back to that. And I think what we should be talking today is what actually went wrong. Because I don't think we are managing this pandemic in the best way globally when we talk about the planet. And I really wonder why this happened. And maybe we can try to identify some of the problems. So when we talked September last year, we agreed that this virus is very seasonal and that it is behaving like a regular respiratory virus, although actually this virus is more vascular than the respiratory, but it's still seasonal. And we chatted about indoor air humidity, which also became a big thing recently, people starting to appreciate how important it is. I think we agreed that the lockdowns are not the way to manage pandemics. And despite the fact that many people still believe that lockdowns are saving lives, they're not. And actually, we chatted then that the lockdowns will actually increase all-cause mortality. And we are seeing this now, that actually people are dying because of the lockdowns. Something we did not completely agree was the second wave. There was a lot of discussion why Eastern Europe was saved in the first wave. Some people were even talking about tuberculosis vaccine and so on, but it was just the spring. Spring saved the Eastern Europe because the Eastern Europe was hit much harder in the second wave than now. So if we go back to seasonality, we see these viruses coming and going. They appear in a winter, they disappear in a summer. And this is why we call them seasonal. But we never test for influenza or for coronaviruses in the middle of summer. So we don't see them. And actually there was one episode of testing, and this was 2009 H1N1 influenza pandemics, when in UK there was a lot of testing in the summer and they were seeing the virus. So virus was there, but people were not severely ill. So obviously, there are many aspects of seasonality. We cannot say that if the virus is seasonal, that it will not exist in summer or that it will not exist in the tropical areas. And we see now that the SARS-CoV-2 is spreading also in the tropical areas. But obviously, there is an effect of season. And one of the important aspects, and there is a huge global initiative called 40 to 60 relative humidity, which talks about the importance of indoor air humidity, because we never evolved in heated spaces. Heated spaces is not something which our biology is adjusted to. And what happens when we heat the air, the air becomes very dry. And this dry air is first inactivating our mucosal barrier. It's making virus droplets evaporate much faster, going into aerosol. So during the summer, virus is mostly staying in a larger droplets, which fall down. So you have to come very close to a person to get infected. In the winter, it goes into aerosol, meaning it's spreading like a cigarette smoke. It's everywhere in the room. And single infected person can infect entire room in the winter. And to make things worse for this virus, it seems it's even more stable when it dried out in these small droplets. So obviously air humidity is something which was very important. And this is something actually we were discussing. This is a figure from my last year chat with you, where we discussed that if you dry the air, if you heat the air, it becomes very dry, even if it's moist outside, if it's humid. But if the temperature is low, when you heat it, inside it becomes very dry. And then this dries out this mucosa barrier. A mucosa barrier is our first front line. This is where the fight against pathogens is going on, because our skin is not easy to penetrate. So viruses and bacteria cannot go through our skin, so they go through our mucosa. And we are protecting the mucosa with many elements of immunity. And one aspect which people tend to ignore are the mucins, the glycoproteins, which mimic glycans on a cell surface, and they act as a trap. So these long polymers are catching viruses. Viruses attach to the mucin. They think they're attaching to the cell, but the mucosal barrier and this mucociliary transport is just flushing them away, and you're getting rid of the bugs. They go out, either you swallow them, but they don't go deeply in the lung. And unfortunately, this whole field of glycobiology, which is, by the way, my field, is being neglected by many scientists. And at the beginning of the pandemic, even the director of NIH was writing about the S-glycoprotein without a single glycan on its structure. While actually, if you look the real image of this protein, all these furry things are glycans. There are more glycans on the surface than the polypeptide. And these glycans actually, and we know now, participate in the binding to the receptor. So this glyco part of the all viral infections are very important. Unfortunately, people were not paying much attention. Another aspect we touched up last year was another role of glycans, and this is balancing inflammation, because this virus is not killing people because it's multiplying in the cells, but because it's overactivating the immune response, and it's our own immune response, such actually inflammation, which kills some people. So this virus is actually not a problem for the vast majority of people. So many people have very mild symptoms, but the frail individuals and individuals where the inflammation is not under control develop this strong inflammatory, overstrong inflammatory response. And actually it's our immune system killing us, which happens in a small subgroup of patients. This is something what David Sinclair and I discussed late last year when we wrote an editorial for aging, where we said that it's actually biological age and not chronological age, which should be the major risk factor in this pandemic. And this was shown to be true. It's actually people who are frail, who develop the severe disease, while people who are biologically younger cope much better. And these are things which one can measure. For example, this glycan age, this is a test which was developed in my lab. It integrates epigenetic, genetic, environmental factors of aging in this single index, which is quantifying low-grade chronic inflammation. I'm very sorry that this seasonality was so suppressed until very recently. And it was suppressed by a decision of something which are called sensors on a social networks. And somebody in this dark world of social networks decided that virus is not seasonal. And if you try to say it is, you're simply removed. Even one of my videos was removed from YouTube because I was talking about virus seasonality. I was showing research papers showing that virus is seasonal, but somebody decided this is not. And this was scary. You know, there is power on this world which can decide what is truth and what is not. There is power who can remove acting president of the United States from a social network. And these things are scary because, you know, we think that we live in a world which is democratic, that where people can make decisions. But we should remember that only a couple hundred years ago, you could not oppose the truth that the sun is circling around the earth. And if you claim that this is not like that, if you say something horrible like that maybe Earth is going around the sun, you get killed. So this is not very different. So we were not killed physically, but all the information, not so much from me. Actually, this was the only example where I was being censored, because I usually write in a language which is not so important to most of the global censors, but so many people in the scientific community were silenced with this kind of pressure, which I think this was the worst thing which happened in this pandemic. And this is that we realized that, you know, it's so easy to manipulate the information, because now when you look, this is very seasonal virus. So this is Europe and US. We had one peak last winter, and then we had another peak this winter. While in South America, the peak was in their winter. Then they had the break again for their summer, and then they have peak again now. So we have two cycles already. So I think nobody is opposing this anymore. But a year ago, it would be very important to know that information. And we were lucky in Croatia because we did a large study. We analyzed over 7,000 people in hospitals all around Europe and in China. And last spring, we already realized that mortality is decreasing, that not only at the level of infection, but also at the level of severity of an infected person, there is a change. And we knew that the summer will be good. And Croatia was one of the most open countries in the summer in the entire second wave. But other countries did not. They stayed in a lockdown during the summer, which was actually harmful. I think Ireland had a lockdown most of the summer. So to slowly summarize what I think that we learned in this pandemic, I think one of the things that we learned is that formal restrictive measures have a very limited effect. So yes, by stopping contact between people, you can stop transmission of a virus, but you cannot order a country to stop moving. It simply did not work. It did not work anywhere in the world. And when you do that, and then you have effects, something like you close the schools and then the reproduction factor is 10% smaller, or you put a ban on public events and then it's another 10% and so on. Yes, you can have 20-30% reduction in transmission maybe, but this is not saving lives. This is just prolonging the period when people get infected. And maybe, just maybe, in some countries like Australia and New Zealand, this will actually save some lives until everybody gets vaccinated. But if we look what is happening now in Australia, they have lockdowns on and off all the time, and they will hold them all winter, their winter, because even if they vaccinate 70% of people, 30% will still be vulnerable. So they did not solve a problem. They just prolonged the problem. And in the same time, this excessive restrictions can actually kill people. And when we look, I focus on Croatia because I'm in Croatia and I'm formerly advisor of our prime minister for COVID. So Croatia had the least stringent measures in Europe, entire second wave. We had the most stringent in the first wave, spring last year, and then we quickly moved to the least stringent, and we remained the least stringent until now. And still, many countries, all our neighboring countries, all similar countries have more people who died. So obviously, by having all these strict lockdowns in Czechia, in Hungary, in Slovakia, they did not save anybody. They actually caused more people to die.
And actually, Gordon, that's an excellent summary thus far. But yeah, just a couple of quick points. On the censorship, we have to remember that the CEO of YouTube in around April 2020 said, anyone who says anything that conflicts with the WHO will be taken down. So they said, we're going to censor. The WHO, though, is a semi-private organization. It's not a government body, so that's very sinister. But also on seasonality, and I've shared this many times last summer, in early July, the WHO came out with an actual announcement and they said SARS-CoV-2 is not seasonal. It is unlike flu. It is not seasonal. So by declaring it was not seasonal, they opened the door, obviously, to anyone saying it was conflicting with the WHO. But that's just the censorship and its own tiny example of the insanity. But on lockdown, what fascinated me is we had tens of papers and analyses that showed exactly what you say, that the effect of lockdown and draconian lockdowns is almost impossible to even measure. Therefore, the hypothesis of lockdowns being effective was falsified last summer. However, the Eastern and Central European countries who claimed a success of lockdown in the spring, but that was actually seasonality and lack of triggering, when they came into the second wave, these countries in general actually locked down pretty early and pretty hard, like you say, the other countries, not Croatia so much. And they were ahead of the game with their lockdown, a perfect test of lockdown effectiveness. They were ahead of the game and they were doing a lot of lockdown because they were the lockdown champions, right? And they masked all over the place. They did everything. And what happened? The curves went on with and became some of the highest mortalities overall cumulative of all of Europe. So there was a dramatic proof that lockdowns and masks are very ineffective. One of 50. So what do you think? This is so obvious scientifically, this point you're making, and yet no one will accept it.
Well, I think this is changing. So this is difficult for people who were very loud in promoting this policy to accept. Some of them are scientists, some of them are politicians, and they have troubles accepting it because, you know, that's the way politics work. You never say you are wrong. You just wait for people to forget about it. So, but I think it's more and more people realizing that this simply did not work. But I have a few more slides. Let me show you a few more slides. So I think one very important lesson we got recently, and this is that actually the excess mortality, and we are now focusing more on excess mortality than just on registered people with a COVID, it's highly dependent on the GDP. So it's generally richer countries with the better healthcare, they manage to save people. And this here, this is Central and Eastern Europe. They really got horrible with all this, as I said, early lockdown, very strict lockdowns. Slovakia had this curfew for, I think, 21 hours a day. You can go out between 4 and 6 in the morning or something like that. Crazy. You were not allowed to go out of the home. So some of these things were just, I think in Greece until recently, you had to send a text message to the police, say, we are going out of the house, give me some kind of, it was just crazy. But you know, Croatia was really opposing this kind of approach. I think the worst thing which happened in Croatia was that the restaurants were closed for 2 or 3 months in the winter, which was not that bad. I think it was bad for them and it was not good, but yeah, that was politics. And when you look at excess mortality, we are in a kind of a better half of these not so rich countries with the least stringent measures. So obviously this is another evidence that measures are not working, but there are now even papers, good papers on a large number of countries. This one is published in Nature Human Behavior in November last year, showing that effects of these measures are really small, something like 10%, 5%, 2%, and they're causing a lot of damage. And I think important conclusion, and this is something what we managed to kind of make official policy in Croatia, is effective things are, you do not have large gatherings, so no. Football match, no public there. It's okay, we can survive without big cheering for a year. And small gatherings have to be limited a bit. Under small, I mean 100 people, 50 people, 150 people, there has to be some regulations to limit the spread of a virus. And I think the most important and the key measure was public education and communication. And we did recently a study where we did a serology in different companies, in mostly in Zagreb, and there were huge differences. So high tech, highly educated people managed to stay protected most of the time. So the infection rate was something between 12 and 18%, while some other companies like security companies, they would have over 50% of people infected. Same city, same measures, all regulations are the same, just the education of people and organization of the work process. And everything else is not effective. Lockdown, border control, air traffic restrictions, test and trace does not work. Isolation of contacts does not really have a strong effect. And now there are more and more papers claiming that. And I think eventually when science will make a decision, will make kind of a decision, this will be a conclusion. And one of the things is lockdown is protecting higher socioeconomic classes. Rich people who can stay at home, have big homes, every child have their own computer, they can work from home, everything gets delivered. Yes, you can protect yourself. But to protect yourself, delivery has to work, restaurants have to cook food for you, everything has, some people have to work to protect you. And I think this is wrong. I think it is wrong to sacrifice the weak part of the society for the richest few. And another thing which I think is coming more and more into the focus of research, and this is actually by locking down people in homes and still allowing some work to keep on going, so somebody has to go to work and make money, you're actually keeping together infected and uninfected people in a confined places for a long time. And there is a higher viral load delivery. And actually you have more severe disease if you have this kind of a setting. And this is something what even very early last year was visible in New York when they started to do serology studies, when NY police department had less infected people than the general population, or the healthcare workers, or the transit workers. They were less infected than the general population. And they were outside all the time and working normally. So I think this is an important lesson. Yeah. And to close, I'm practically finished. I want to touch up on the variants, because new variants are appearing all the time. And we have thousands of them. And they could be somewhat a threat to countries with a low incident prevalence of vaccinated or previous infected people. Finland, Greece, Germany, there could be some additional spread because of the new variants, because yes, if you focus virus to fight for its life, it will evolve in a way to be more contagious. But for the majority of countries in Europe, in US, we are all above 50% infected, probably vaccinated between 40, 50, 80%. So we could have a tiny little bit of new infection. So vaccines, viruses mutate all the time, new variants will appear. Some of them could be more contagious, maybe some may not. But at the moment, in most of the countries, we have something like this. This is Croatia. This is the hospital admissions per day. We are practically at the bottom. And because of the number of people infected and because of the number of people vaccinated, even with all those variants, we could have a small little bump. There is no way we could come anywhere close to what happened this winter. So I think it's, I don't think we will be recording this in a year.
Excellent, Gordon. And, you know, I might just pick up on the last point then, the variants. And I've been putting out some videos lately trying to explain what you said about the variants. And for in England, for example, in April, the Indian variant or Delta, most people don't realize it's the same thing now. It's like there's two variants, Indian and Delta, but they're the same thing. In England in April, it was coming up to 10% of all PCR positives were the Delta variant. And in mid-May, it was up to 70%. And by the end of May, it was up to 90% plus. So in the 2 months where that scary variant or scariant took over completely, in that whole 2 months, nothing happened hospital admissions. Nothing happened mortality. So it was almost a de facto proof that, right, the variant takes over. It's a natural evolution of the virus. But it can't do much more when you have a population that's been saturated effectively. And just on the point about the vaccines, I keep pointing out to people that say, well, okay, but the vaccines now have been rolled out quite a lot in the UK. And that is true. But I showed them the graph for last year when the summer came in and the virus effectively disappeared. And it's a mirror image of this year. But there were no meds or medications last year. So I just say, you got to be careful. It's fine to attribute credit to technology, which should mitigate. But just be careful when the exact same pattern occurred last year in the UK with a long summer of no problem and there were no medications. Just be careful logically. I think that's a fair point to make. So the variants, it appears, are being used now massively politically. So they're being used in Ireland and the UK to keep lockdown measures in place. I mean, that is the only thing. The hospitals are empty. No one's really dying. It's been months since we had a problem. We're in the middle of the summer. And the variants seem to be the only tool now available in order to convince the people to stay with restrictive measures. And that's actually fraud, essentially, in my mind, personally. That's data fraud.
Yeah. So I get shocked occasionally when I speak to some of my colleagues in Ireland, Belgium, UK, how actually scared they are. That they're actually afraid that something horrible is going to happen. And they all overestimate the mortality of this virus by an order of magnitude. And it's all this propaganda, which I continuously wonder why. For example, in Croatia, I do have reasonable influence. I'm a formal advisor of Prime Minister. And when I look into this information, which is being distributed to the media, most of the times it can be pinpointed to the people who are actually making a lot of profit in this pandemic. Because it's this industry of testing became, I think, the largest industry in the world. Because it's a huge amount of tests. So Croatia is on the bottom of the scale in Europe by the number of tests that we are doing. And we already spend, I think, 1.5 billion kunas on this testing. And PCR testing, and I have a PCR lab, I know the technology. And this is 90% profit margin on all different levels, from the production. So the raw cost of testing is virtually zero. So the kit producers make profit, distributors make profit, laboratories make profit. And I think this is one of the reasons why people want to keep this going. Because when you have this huge amount of profit which just accumulated, you can easily use it to persuade some of the scientists or journalists to go your way. And I'm not sure about politics. Because the idea is that, you know, politicians would like to be more, at least I think so, that every politician wants to be successful. And now they all try to strangle their own countries, because what is going on with the economies all around Europe, that this is going to be a disaster. If you look what is happening in US, and US is exploding with their recovery, and China, I don't know what will happen to Europe at the end. And we did it to ourselves.
I saw it since last summer when the data was clear as crystal, pretty much, and nothing's changed since then. I saw it as a kind of an unscientific or anti-scientific mass delusion. And I think the politicians, like, what type of people go into politics? Are they the hardcore, nerdy, technical types? You know, that side of the brain? No, it's the opposite, right? We know what their talents are, and they're not technical. So the politicians are ripe to be misled. And also for politicians, you've got one mega issue you keep focusing on, and you look like a hero because it appears that you put in restrictions that appeared to save granny. And everyone's terrified in the population because of the media propaganda, over 12 months of literally 24-hour propaganda. So the politician has an easy job. They don't need to worry about the deficit, blame it on the virus. They don't need to worry about any other challenges and the upcoming debt mountain and the catastrophic effect on the future of our children. No worries, blame it on the virus. And you've got one issue everyone's focused on, so you don't need to answer questions on all the other issues, because they're less focused on. It's like being a war president. Remember Bush? Oh, I'm a war president. Everyone's focusing on a war. You kind of get away with everything else. So I think there's lots of reasons. What I said was the tip of the iceberg. There's an epidemic of fear in the people that causes them to demand the politicians to keep them safe. The politicians deliver the junk science, lockdowns and all, and then the people are happier. But the more restrictions and the more masks, the more people believe they're under risk. So like you say, they have an orders of magnitude higher perception of the risk. And I might just add, for risk, Gordon, get your opinion on this. I did the real world actual risk level for this issue. And Ireland has had over a year and two full seasonal surges, two epidemics. And the positivity in PCR in the testing was over 25% in each epidemic surge, seasonal surge. So we know it's been everywhere. So now we can look back and say, well, what was the risk over a full year with massive spread, right? And you know what it was? For an under 70s person, as that whole group, it was around 1 in 8,000 for mortality. And that include overwhelmingly comorbid people. For healthy people under 70, it'd be vastly lower. Under 50 years old, as a whole group, 1 in 50,000 risk. And again, if you were healthy, you can divide that by another 5 or 10. And under 25s was 1 in 280,000. Okay? And everyone who died, the 5 or 6 in Ireland under 25, all major comorbidities and, you know, serious conditions. These risks are literally tiny by any sane person's estimation. And yet everyone perceives that the risks were really high. But it's a falsehood.
Yep, I agree. And then when you look, so Ireland had this very severe lockdowns all the time. And actually, when you compare mortality in Ireland, for example, in Croatia, I think it's nearly half of what we had. So with everything what you have done, this 1 in 8,000 may be changed into 1 in 5,000 or the vice versa, but or 1 in 200,000 to 1 in 100,000. So for a single individual, this was not a major difference. And so all this was to reduce a very small risk a little bit more.
And to be honest, if you compare with Sweden in excess mortality or mortality above you'd expect, Sweden only had around 3,000 extra deaths. If you look at the figures properly, like Professor Michael Levitt of Stanford and his team, a few thousand out of 10 million people. and an average age close to life expectancy. So Sweden had the least restrictions, and we had the CNN teams in there last May, and people are all in restaurants. They didn't even observe the 1 meter, really. They had no masks, and they had kids up to 16 in school right throughout, and no signal for extra risk for any of the teachers involved in those schools. So Sweden was the minimum, and their impact was just relatively tiny. And if you age correct, they were around the same as Ireland. So minimal restrictions in Sweden was really around the same as Ireland, which had max. I mean, again and again, there is no signal worth a damn for lockdown effectiveness anywhere.
When you look at this success mortality, which I have shown, it's mostly the GDP which it correlates to, and not the measures. So, and you know, and it's this counting of people who died is also very problematic, because, for example, what we have now in Croatia is that few people die now, but still more than what we would expect based on the number of people who get hospitalized because of COVID. But what happens is that, at least in our system, that most of the people die in hospitals. So people who are very old, they tend to stay even for weeks or months in a hospital before they die, because we still have this remnant of the socialist healthcare system where you don't actually pay for the hospital. And then these very frail and dying people get SARS-CoV-2 as a hospital infection. Their immunity is collapsing, and then you have relatively, because we have few people dying per day, it's a small number still, but when you look at the excess mortality, there will be no excess mortality in this period, because these people would die anyway, with or without this virus. And we have interesting situation. For example, in Zagreb, we have two hospitals, two major COVID hospitals. One is a hospital for infectious diseases, and the other one is one of the general hospitals, which was transformed in a COVID hospital. And mortality between these two hospitals differs by a threefold, which is crazy. You know, it's the same country, same level of the healthcare. It cannot be that the mortality in hospital A is three times higher than the mortality of hospital B. But what happens in a hospital B is that every sick old person in other hospitals who get this virus is transferred to that hospital. So it's people dying not because of COVID, but people dying with COVID. So I think from the official number of people who died, at least in the Croatian setting, at least half did not die because of a virus. They were dying anyway, and they just got the virus on the way.
You know, and in Sweden, Anders Tegnell the other day was interviewed a year after. You remember you said you can judge me in a year's time after the next season. And he was able to go on camera for 10 minutes and effectively state everything we're saying. And he was correct. And no one in the world sadly knows it. But in Sweden, they had the classic graph of the supposed 9,000 deaths in the epidemic. And they showed the people who truly were more of COVID rather than with. And it was 800 or 900, because there was vast comorbidity and aged frailty in the big figure. And even that was a false figure, the 9,000, because that was PCR positive passings within 28 days. But the actual excess mortality over expected was way lower. It was a couple of thousand. It fascinates me now in Ireland, the media have talked about 4,800 deaths in total extra. And it's actually false, because the Central Statistics Office and the GRO database, it is now clear that 2020, the numbers who died in Ireland overall, around 32,000, is the same as 2018, 32,000. That's a fact. And the April 2020 surge, where we had 3,700 die in the April COVID surge epidemic month, well, in January 2018, in a bad flu month, there were 3,600 and something. So 2020 is the same as 18, and the surge in 2020 is effectively the same as 2018. But no one knows this because the media is producing figures and using with COVID to make it look like thousands of people extra died. And the last thing I'll say about Ireland, which was just stunning to me, and I came out last May saying this, it was in RTE, Ireland's national broadcaster, they slipped up and they let a little fact out. And the fact was that 19 out of 20 people who died with SARS-CoV-2, positive PCR, were never given an ICU treatment. And the reason was 19 out of 20, independent of COVID-2 infection, were so aged and frail that it was not ethical to ever try and save them with ICU, regardless of what they were suffering from. So in other words, 95% of our epidemic, where everyone in Ireland was terrified, 95% of the deaths were people who would not be given an ICU under any circumstances because they were already effectively 1 foot out the door of this world. Isn't it astonishing that those facts are there and yet people believe there was a big risk?
Yep. I remember the 90s when the former Yugoslavia was breaking apart. And then there was a war in this region. And the truth is something very relative. And what people believe can also change very quickly with the made media brainwash in a couple of months or a year. It's unbelievable how you can actually change what people think just by feeding them the same information all the time. So it's... this is something what scares me in this pandemic, because when it started, I was seriously concerned that it will be really a serious one, because the initial estimates of 3.5% people dying, that's a lot of mortality. It's not worth, there were worse viruses. There were viruses which were killing every third person, but even every one in a 30, it's still a lot of mortality. And I just wonder, what would happen to our civilization if we were hit with a virus like that? Because we barely survived this one, which was really not so serious. You know, 99.5% of everybody infected, maybe even 99.7, survived. So it's something people would be willing to take a risk. You know, you stand in front of 100 people and say, not 100, 300 people and say, kill one of them. You'll take a chance and then go on living. But yeah, it is. I'm not too optimistic about, you know, this civilization after this experiment.
Yeah, and I agree, Gordon. The sinister aspect is what really got me very engaged last summer. And I think for me, a red letter day or a crucial point when I realized how sinister this was when in the middle of the summer, when it was 100% clear that it was seasonal and it had collapsed relating to that factor and the community immunity that builds, classic flu curve, collapsing in summer, they brought in mandatory masks, mandatory prison sentences and fines all across Europe at the nadir when nothing was happening and it was clearly seasonally collapsed until the next winter where there would be a resurgence, which we saw, which we predicted. But mandatory masks were brought in when nothing was happening. Therefore, what would drive that utterly anti-scientific implementation? And if you bring in mandatory masks where your whole citizenry are now told they're covered their face, which is a big deal. You know, people say, oh, masks are fine. They're fine if they're voluntary. They're not fine if everyone has told you must or you'll go to prison. But if you bring that in when nothing is happening, how do you ever take it back out? If you bring it in when there's a big epidemic, you can maybe take it out when there's not a big epidemic. But when there's nothing going on, well, when are you going to take masks back out when we're actually resurrecting people, right? When people are rising from the graves, you see?
Well,
We never had obligatory masks outside in Croatia. And there was one attempt to introduce them in the city of Zagreb when there was, I forgot exactly when, so local kind of head of this public health authority said that Zagreb will introduce masks. But there was such a revolt. Everybody was doing what they can. I was also personally writing to the prime minister saying, you know, this is crazy. And they were not allowed to do it. So the national authority blocked it. So we never had it, fortunately. So it's, you know, maybe I'm, so I lived through whole epidemics in a country which behaved more or less normally. So beside March and April last year, you know, we more or less functioned. Yes, we do have put a mask on when we go into the shop, but more or less this is it. And I think 80% of people will have them below their nose because, you know, we all know that they don't do much.
Yeah.
But kind of, you know, obey the rule.
So in a way, Croatia is another beautiful proof point, like Florida that dropped all the measures and the mandatory masks last September 2020, and they've done fine, same as everyone else or better. Texas similarly several months ago, and South Dakota versus North Dakota comparison, no masks and no lockdown south and north, the same people, same region, but they did all the lockdowns and masks. Their curves are mirrored. And you can add Croatia now that did the least lockdown and obviously a trivial amount of masking. And they're the best performer with lowest mortality versus all their neighbors in the region who did ultra hard lockdowns and masks everywhere. Professor Karl Popper, the brilliant man, you know, who talked about the nature of scientific proof, that there's an asymmetry of proof, that all you need is one negative example against a hypothesis and the hypothesis is dead. But you can have 1,000 examples that support the hypothesis, associations, and they never prove it. The power of a negative example. And now we have scores of negative proofs. We only need one good one, but we have myriad. And yet, here we are, the belief persists about lockdown. I might ask one question on, I did an interview way back with Gábor Erdősi from Hungary, who's a genius on metabolic science and immunology. He's a molecular biologist, but he went through the evidence for the lab leak. Now, Gordon, 6 months ago, we would not be allowed to talk about this because remember, Facebook would censor you and YouTube if you talked about lab leak. But now it's been announced in the media the last month that you're now allowed to talk about lab leak. Now it's allowed again. So what do you think about the lab leak? We went through 4 key properties of the virus that each make it highly unlikely for natural evolution. And when you multiply those together in probability theory, you've got to multiply all the small probabilities. It looks almost certain that it is laboratory gain of function, which is a 30-year-old technology. People think it's science fiction. It's 30-year-old technology. It's just no one did it because it's unethical. But what do you reckon about that lab origin story?
So I think it's very hard to prove that virus leaked from a lab, but it is also not possible to disprove it. So I think it's a probable and plausible option. But I think this is not very relevant because we are not as smart as we think we are. We don't know how to design a virus to be a particularly dangerous. So even if they were doing experiments in a lab, they were more or less doing some kind of a random combinations of maybe different proteins from different viruses. But this is happening all the time. You know, every infected person will have hundreds of millions of viruses with mutations happening in every replication. It's RNA virus. It doesn't have a very strict replication. Mm. So I think variants are happening all the time within a person, within a population, between the species transfers. So I don't think that this is a virus which was made as a weapon. First, it's not dangerous enough. You know, if you want to make a weapon, you will make a weapon which is more efficient. They were doing experiments in Wuhan, definitely. It could have leaked. it could have infected some of the people in the lab and then spread around. It's possible. I don't know what would be the legal repercussions, but probably, you know, you cannot blame somebody for getting infected. So I don't think this is, I think it's more politics now than that it really matters.
Yeah, no, very good. I think the four key qualities that Gábor went through pretty deeply, the only thing I might add is they could easily be encouraged in gain of function. The technology is not too hard. And each of them as well does enable it to do what we see SARS-CoV-2 did. In terms of making a really dangerous one, I guess no one would really want to make a really dangerous one. Maybe this amount of danger that we've described the risk is enough to cause disruption. So you could get into all kinds of theories. But I think I'd circle back though, because I think we've covered everything and we've completely given a great companion piece to our discussion last September. But maybe we'll finish with probably for me what is the key thing, the lockdown and mask lack of effectiveness and the seasonality. And one of your main points was by locking down in the summer, if anything, we'd enhance the level of problem in the coming season because we limit, you know, community immunity and relatively safe spread and immune T cell, you know, levels getting higher. So do you reckon in the end that the lockdown kind of did maximize, or more really that the lockdown just didn't really achieve anything, only an enormous cost to society, but didn't really change the next season much?
So I think this would probably be different in a different locations and a different countries and different situations and different socioeconomic stratifications. Because, for example, even now in Croatia, where we had probably over 50% of people get infected, there is still a significant amount of highly educated, highly skilled workers who were not infected, who managed to protect themselves. So I don't think this was lockdown, because we never had a lockdown. It was personal responsibility, personal caution, thinking what you are doing, trying not to get infected. You can avoid high risk settings and reduce the risk of getting infected. This is of course possible. But on a country level, I think allowing virus to spread to some extent during the summer is not dangerous, because people are not sick, people are not in the hospitals, and getting a small amount of virus is still training your immune system. And I think one of the good examples are the cashiers. I think there are several studies about cashiers in the different large companies and in different countries, and they generally never got ill. And they were seeing thousands of people. So,
well, actually, Gordon, the cashier point I find really key, because late April, I was already putting down the evidence that lockdowns are ineffective. And we only had one published paper from Woods Hole at that point, the Institute, saying that on an analysis of many countries. But I was saying to people, for God's sake, guys, you don't need to be an expert problem solver, right, or highly technical. A relation of mine worked this out. And what he worked out was he'd gone to all the stores that were still open. There were no masks in April 2020 in Ireland in the middle of the epidemic. Indoors, right, indoors with 8 or 10 foot ceilings, all of the shop workers were exposed 8 hours a day to all of the great unwashed people coming in, right, shopping. Shelf stackers, there were older ladies who were very overweight. There were plenty of people who would be prone to a pretty bad infection. And the newspapers actually reported it. I kept the clippings. The supermarket workers escaped infection and mortality. They had no higher signal than anyone else. So that was an elegant proof that these non-lockdown people with huge exposure indoors, no masks, to all of the people with token distancing, that indoors, they showed no signal. I mean, you know, I was pulling my hair out last April about this.
Yep, you see what happened to our hairs. We have no hair.
Only the minority of sane people are the ones who are suffering at this incredible lack of scientific and logical thinking. But you know, that's probably, I know you've got a lot to do the rest of your day, Gordon, so it might be a point to wrap it up with that statement. I mean, this has been, and I have been 30 years in complex problem solving and truth in science, data and logic. That's been my whole life. And the last year for me has been an excruciatingly painful year because I have never seen the whole world reject science and logic wall to wall. And yet here we are.
Yeah, it's not the whole world, but the big part of the world.
Yeah.
You know, there are more and more people who are now starting to talk. Unfortunately, so many scientists were silenced with this peer pressure, with the authority pressure. And now they don't want to stay silent anymore because it's just getting absurd.
Yeah. And I think that's what that is the hope in the future, that people will now get the courage. And I realize I've used the word cowardice before and it's harsh. I feel many people have displayed profound cowardice. And I know other people may have four children and a big mortgage. And in fairness, they can't speak up because they've got to look after their family. But a lot of people who were independently okay financially and had the ability to speak up without incurring major personal damage chose not to. They kind of just kept their head down and just waited for it to go away. And it's a very dangerous thing. You referred to previous wars and conflicts, and we know the 1930s in Europe, what happened. It's very dangerous to keep your head down and hope things go away, because things can just continue to escalate. And by the time you realize, I better speak up now, it can often be too late. So that's something everyone needs to be thinking. Courage, guys. If you understand what myself and Gordon have discussed, talk about it at the water cooler. Talk about it to your relations. Make it part of the conversation. It'll all help, right?
Yeah, I agree. Nice talking to you.
Absolutely, Gordon. And I'm sure we'll circle back again and see how things develop at a later point. So
no more God bless Croatia. Let's talk about nice. Okay. Bye.
Thank you. Don't forget to subscribe and also to hit that little bell icon to make sure you're informed and get to counter some of the more corporate style science that's out there. So all the links are in the description box below. And also really appreciate all my PayPal and Patreon supporters and anyone else who can continue to support me to provide all the material that I do. It's highly appreciated. So thank you.